introduction to international finance markets, law and practice. We want to understand the nature and importance of the international financial system and each of the key markets within that. We're going to look very briefly at the history of banking and finance, banking, international finance, international trade and merchant finance, merchant banking, investment banking. We need to understand the difference between a commercial bank, a merchant bank, and an investment bank. We'll look at the international financial system. We can principally understand this in terms of crises. Five of the key crises in history were the gold standard, Bretton Woods, petrodollar and debt crisis, Asia and Russian crisis, and then the global financial crisis, 2008-2009. We'll look at the main markets. We'll look at the money markets, the capital markets, the euro dollar markets, euro bond and secondary markets, financial derivatives, currency, gold, commodity and insurance markets. We can also reconsider this in terms of financial assets and claims. I thought this was interesting. I haven't seen it done before. What I tried to do was identify all of the key products, instruments or claims dealt with on the markets. So we can either look at the markets or we can look at the items dealt with on the markets. So what I came up with was a 25-point structure to explain all the available key types of instruments and claims. Five under coinage and currency, credit and payment, public debt, corporate securities, risk and investment assets. And if we go back over it, we can understand all the different types of specific instruments, claims, products dealt with on each of the key markets that we've just dealt with before. We'll then highlight the importance of International Financial Centre, especially in terms of the key activities carried on in each, as well as the nature of international global investment banking. Now, what does an investment bank do? There's principally eight core sets of activities: equity and debt underwriting, market making and trading, asset management, advisory services, trade finance, foreign exchange and financial derivatives, prime brokerage, and now I've put other activities, but that specifically includes what we call structured finance. Structured finance is essentially the new markets for highly leveraged, designed types of new instruments, including specifically collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, as well as other types of structured products, such as collateralized mortgage obligations, CMOs, collateralized loan obligations, CLOs, collateralized equity obligations, CEOs. There's a whole series of them in the structured finance area, so we could include structured finance under 8 as well. I've also provided a summary of the history of investment banking in the post-war period, essentially looking at all of the main institutions, the biggest banks and securities firms in America, in Wall Street, how they originated and evolved, especially under what was called the Glass-Steagall Act 1933, which was essentially part of the Banking Act 1933, which separated commercial banking from securities business. We will then see how that was reformed, replaced with the creation of what are called financial holding companies now in America under the Financial Competitiveness Act 1999, which is one of the last statutes that Bill Clinton signed. It's also called the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. But what we'll also see is a combination of the deregulation with Gramm-Leach-Bliley 1999 in America and the Commodity Modernization Futures Act 2000. A lot of people actually blame those two statutes for creating the conditions which led to the global financial crisis in 2008. So again, all of this is in the paper, or we can build up the details separately as well. I also explain British merchant banking in the post-war period, all of the major banks, all of the major names, and how once we deregulated the system, we had a big bang in London in 1986, there was a big bang in New York in 1975, but as soon as we opened up the markets in London in 1986, what happened was all of the very wealthy foreign large banks and financial institutions bought up all the British merchant banks almost immediately. So I explain all of that. I also explain the background to the Japanese system with the four big Japanese securities houses as well, and mention the European system. The rest of the paper then looks at the nature of international commercial banking. It specifically refers to cross-border banking and capital adequacy. We'll come back to this on a couple of occasions. You don't need to understand the detail, but you need to know about it. This is to do with the fact that banks have to keep a core regulatory capital requirement to cover their lending. The key number was 8%. So all banks in the world had to keep 8% capital against their lending under what was called the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision Capital Accord in 1988. We very substantially revised that in 2004 by creating a three-pillar system, and then we revised it again following the global financial crisis in 2010, where we substantially increased the amounts. All you need to know for the purposes of this class is that the way capital adequacy works is that banks hold an amount of capital against their total lending, which includes their euro-dollar lending. So if you lend 100 million in the euro-dollar market, you will effectively allocate 8% of your capital on your accounts against that loan. And if you haven't got enough capital, you raise more capital, or you just don't lend. It acts as a core limit on how much banks can lend. Historically, the 8% of itself means that you can lend 12.5 times your balance sheet value. Why? Because the obverse of 8 is 12.5. You divide 8 into 100, that's 12.5. So if you have 8% minimum, it means you can lend 12.5 times your capital base. But what would happen in practice is that's called a risk-adjusted capital figure. If we risk adjust, we take out the lower elements, you can actually lend up to 3 times that. So it's more like 20, 30 times your capital you can lend. But still, this is an important limit on how much banks can lend. At the same time, banks must remain solvent at all times. If they're not solvent, they lose the right to conduct business, so their license is removed. If you lend too much, you haven't got enough cover against that, you're insolvent technically because your assets outweigh your liabilities. The way this market actually works is that it's not a deposit market, it's not a cover market. A typical bank in the euro dollar markets will have a deposit base. Let's, for example, say its loan book is 100 million. It may have 60 million deposit base. It may have another 20, 30 of wholesale lending. All that has to happen is, on a daily basis, if it lends more, it simply goes into the interbank markets to top up to make sure it stays solvent. The difficulty that arises with the background to a lot of these markets is that a lot of the writing, from a finance theory perspective, from an economic theory, misrepresents, misstates, I think misunderstands a lot of this. If we look at it from a core legal perspective, can see very clearly what's happening. We can then understand the international financial system in terms of this basic core paper. So let's just work through this in some detail. You can follow all of this yourself. International financial markets are the largest markets in the world. These essentially recreate themselves as part of the euro-dollar system in the post-war period. What we're essentially concerned with is the transfer of assets from around the world to London to then be recycled through the London markets and redistributed around the rest of the world. This begins with the movement of dollar assets from the United States to London, so that London becomes the primary offshore centre for dollar debt in the post-war period, but then all other forms of excess funds from anywhere else in the world will be transferred to London, recycled through the London system, and then reused around the rest of the world. London is the key financial centre for intermediation. That's why it's the key international financial centre of the world, and still is the key international financial centre of the world. More of the largest markets in the world are based in London than anywhere else. More of the largest financial institutions in the world are based in London than anywhere else. We are specifically then looking at the nature of the euro-dollar market. You'll see here, we have an interbank market, we have a euro lending or loan market, and we have a euro bond or debt-based security market. We've also then got shorter duration instruments, including euro notes, down to commercial paper, which is less than 1 year, as well as a range of other types of specific instruments. We have the financial derivatives market, which really develops after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, which technically ended on 15th August 1971, when Richard Nixon closed the gold window, which meant that other countries in the world could no longer exchange their currency for gold, which brought to an end the gold exchange standard that was established under the Bretton Woods system in 1944. That had created stable international monetary conditions for the 30-40 year period after the Second World War, 1944. All of the reconstruction in Europe and elsewhere around the world was all based on that stable international system, which was originated on, worked on the basis of this gold standard, gold exchange standard, which had replaced the earlier gold markets. London then re-emerges as this new international financial centre. From the 1970s onwards specifically, we see the emergence of a whole range of new risk management instruments, including specifically financial derivatives, futures, options and swaps. And then from the 1980s and 1990s, we move into credit derivatives, which are effectively using derivatives as a form of insurance instrument. And then this again emerges and develops into what we call the structured finance market. And I've mentioned all of this in here. We have the credit-linked note market, we have collateralized debt obligations, we have credit default swaps, and we can come back and look at all of this in further detail. From a legal perspective, the key point is this: a number of core issues arise with regards to structure and documentation, pricing and disclosure, payment, clearing and settlement, as well as simply the core nature of all of the different claims, assets and instruments involved in each of these markets. So we need to understand all of that, and that's the purpose of the course, to review and examine and explain all of this. The way the market works in practice is that because it is so large, there is no single international agency capable of regulating this market. All of the governments in the world borrow in this market. All of the largest companies in the world borrow or lend in this market. So there's no organisation or country large enough to regulate the market, so the market regulates itself. It does that on the basis of trade associations. In each of the key markets, the major financial institutions come together. They form their own trade group. Loan Market Association, LMA, in banking. International Capital Markets Association, ICMA, bonds, notes and paper, and then International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA, in the derivatives area. There's a range of other trade associations which we'll also mention later, but these are the three most important. Effectively, we create a form of surrogate, substitute or proxy regulation without the need for formal regulation and governments or international agencies through the use of private documentation and private law, drafted by the major international law firms, instructed by the trade associations. The banks themselves don't have the documentation. They provide the funds. Where does the documentation come from? It's drafted by the law firms. This market is basically run by law firms. Private documentation, private markets, private law creates a form of alternative, substitute or proxy regulation for the largest financial system in the world. We've got the history of banking and finance. This all emerges out of early forms of banking. Banking itself goes way back to, for example, Babylonian times. The first bank was the House of Egebi in Egypt between 600 and 482 BC. We actually have recovered 1,700 clay tablets from that time, from early banking and ledger transactions in Egypt, 600 BC in Babylonia. Absolutely astonishing. The first international bank was actually the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar were originally set up by Hugh de Payne in 1119. Hugh de Payne married Catherine de Sinclair, the Sinclair family in Scotland, which created a very close relationship between the Knights Templar and the Scottish families and the Scottish kings and queens subsequently. The Knights Templar will emerge from the early 1100s as the principal international lenders and capitalists in the world at that time. They actually existed for 188 years before, then that's 100. That's 715 years ago. They actually operated for almost 200 years, and they became the largest, amongst the largest new capitalists, landholders, and lenders in Europe at that time. What eventually happened was the kings and queens, the Vatican, and specifically Philip the Simple in France, became very jealous of their wealth, and he wanted to try and take it off them, so therefore they were closed down. They were actually made illegal on 13th October 1307. That's Friday the 13th. That's where the superstition about Friday the 13th comes from, because that was the day on which Philip the Simple closed down the Knights Templar at that time. The then Grand Master was Jacques de Molay, and the various other leaders, they were tortured and then ultimately executed. I think they were actually burnt by the French royal family at that time. Why? Because the French king was looking for the massive amount of wealth that they had accumulated, including other forms of cultural wealth, such as the Ark of the Covenant and various other items like that. What were almost certain was these had been removed from Jerusalem by the Knights Templar. They had been brought through France, possibly to London, to Temple Church. I'm a member of Inner Temple. And then up to Scotland to Roslyn Chapel, and then from Roslyn Chapel to North America through what's called Oak Island. The first international banking dynasty was effectively the Knights Templar. All of the early practices of being able to move funds, having deposit systems, creating international trade and exchange, was all developed by the Knights Templar over this 180-year period. What will then happen is a lot of the best practice from that is then transferred to the new emerging banking systems and banking families which will emerge. We had what we call the Dark Ages, when trade and commerce collapsed in Europe, basically from the end of the Roman Empire, which was around 472 AD. From around 500 AD to 1100, that's the Dark Ages. There's no trade, there's no commerce, there's no business for between 500 and 600 years. We then get the beginning of trade again, in particular in Italy and other major European cities. And a lot of this develops from the 11th, 12th, 1300s onwards in the forms of fairs. We have village fairs, we have town fairs, and we have great fairs where merchants from across countries all come together. And these great fairs would grow in the 12th, 13th and 14th centuries and become very large indeed. Places like Bruges became very famous because of these new market systems. The great fairs could last 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. They would also develop their own court systems, their own legal systems. We call that the Lex Mercatoria, or the law merchant. But they principally developed three key forms of payment instrument: the bill of exchange, the promissory note, and later the check. What would happen is at the fairs, and I mention all this in the text, this is trade and merchant finance and then merchant banking. What would happen at the fairs is that the merchants wanted to pay each other, but they didn't have cash or they didn't want to use their specie. So what would happen is one merchant owed money to another merchant who wanted to buy something from another merchant. So the first merchant would tell the second merchant to pay the third merchant. You would record that on a small piece of paper. You have a drawer, a drawee, and the amount and when it's to be paid. That's an early bill of exchange. What would then happen is this could pass around the whole fair. So the merchant receiving the bill from, you've told this lady to pay this lady because this lady owes you and you want to buy something from her, you can then sell something to the next lady, to gentleman, 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 lady, 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 and this can pass all the way around the fair. This can exchange, transfer for up to 3 months. Initially, you can write the name of the next person on it, so you endorse it by name specifically, or you can just endorse it in blank. So it just passes by delivery. So this bill can literally pass all round the fair for 1 month, 2 months, and 3 months. At the end of the fair, this lady's holding it, and this lady will present it to this lady because she's ultimately liable on the bill, as well as technically anybody else who signed the bill. That was the most important payment instrument in the world for almost 600 years, the bill of exchange. What actually happened was this. We get a bill of exchange market emerging in London, and we call it the Bill on London. And what would happen is this. People are trading in China, South America, Russia, anywhere in the world. We're selling tea, we're selling silk, we're selling metals. But what would happen is this. All of the merchants all around the world send all the bills to London. That's called the Bill on London. Two specialist banks emerge called the Merchant, the Acceptance House and the Discount House. It's all in the text. What would happen is this. The Acceptance House receives the bill and stamps it. This is a specialist bank that's going to stamp the bill and sign it. What does that do? It adds the bank's credit, so the bank becomes liable on the bill, so the bill becomes as good as a banknote, becomes as good as cash. Because in those times, the banknotes weren't issued by governments, the banknotes were issued by the banks themselves, private banks. So if you stamp the bill, it becomes as good as cash. What you can then do is you discount it. So you go to the bank next door. So one bank's the Acceptance House, the bank next door is the Discount House. And what you do is you sell the bill to the Discount House. The Discount House will always buy it because it's as good as cash because a bank's already signed it. And what the Discount House does is this. It calculates the interest that's left until payment. If it's 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, or 12 months, it looks at the tables, it calculates the interest until payment, and it deducts it from the face value. So if the bill is £100, if it's got 3 months left till payment, let's say you're going to pay in 3 months, the interest is £1, the Discount House buys it for £99. It buys it and it pays 99, which is the discount, which is its charge for waiting the 3 months to present it for payment. This was the most important payment instrument almost in history for 600 years. Most of the trade in the world was done through bills of exchange. You didn't need cash, you didn't need gold, you didn't need silver. It was just merchants selling credit amongst themselves. This then becomes formalized in London through the use of the Acceptance House and the Discount Houses. And then what will happen is this. Out of these Discount Houses and Merchant Houses will emerge the merchant banks, the British early English banks or merchant banks. One more point just before that. Legal tender in the form of banknotes actually begins in Sweden with the Bank of Sweden in 1661. The Bank of England becomes the most important central bank, but it's not actually set up until 1694 by a Scotsman called William Paterson. But what will happen is during the 1600s, as London emerges as the most important financial centre in the world, we get the growth of early goldsmith bankers. And modern banking, so we had Babylonian banks going back to the EGB, 600 AD. Then we had international banking with the Knights Templar in 1100, 1200. And then we have the Great Fairs, North Italy, and then spreading around the rest of Europe, 1300, 1400. Modern banking begins in the city of London in the 1600s. And what would happen is this. Merchants and wealthy individuals wouldn't want to keep valuable assets in their own house because it wasn't secure. They would deposit them with a goldsmith or a silversmith because they had lock rooms and usually guards and various forms of security. The goldsmiths realized if they're receiving large bags of gold and silver, they don't have to just keep it on deposit. What they will do is they issue a receipt for it. They issue a receipt for the gold that's deposited. What would then happen is the person who's got the receipt, they would then begin to circulate the receipt, and that becomes an early banknote. So the English banknotes emerged out of the receipts issued by the goldsmiths. But what the goldsmiths also realised was this. They didn't just have to issue a receipt. What they could also do is lend a large amount of the gold and silver that they had received. Because they knew that not everybody would ask for all their gold and silver back immediately. And what actually happened was the early number that emerges is 30-70%. They're going to keep 30% gold and silver and lend 70% of it. And how do they lend that 70%? They could lend the actual gold and silver. The easiest way, however, is to issue more receipts. Do you see? So the receipts are used initially to register the deposit of the funds which had been left with the goldsmith, but then also for lending purposes. This is the beginning of modern banking. Because banking isn't deposit taking and it's not lending. Banking is when you do the two together. That's banking. So this all begins in London in the 1640s, 1660s, 1680s. The Bank of England is then set up by a Scotsman, William Paterson, in 1694. And the Bank of England simply copies all of these practices which had been developed by the goldsmith bankers, partly on the earlier practices that had been developed in North Italy and then spread around the rest of Europe. And that is a short history of banking and the modern financial system. English merchant banks are the early types of banks which would grow out of the goldsmith banks. These are deposit banks. Commercial banking is when you receive deposits, you pool the deposits and you on-lend it. We call that maturity transformation, or it creates what we call a maturity mismatch. The banks fund themselves short, sight on demand, and they lend medium to long term. The genius of banking, the art of banking, is managing the risk that that creates. They fund themselves through short demand deposits, they lend medium to long term. It's managing that maturity mismatch, that maturity transformation. That's what banking is about. That's the art of banking. Traditionally, as I've said, the banks keep 30% in reserve, they lend 70% of their assets, so they've always got a reserve. Subsequently, later, we'll then develop what we call lender of last resort. Begins in the 1800s, Walter Bagehot writing in Lombard Street, 1873. Three Bagehot rules, three modern lender of last resort rules. Lend to a bank only if it's liquid, illiquid but solvent. Secondly, you can lend to an insolvent bank, but only if its closure would create instability in other banks, which would create contagion or a domino effect and collapse the financial system. And thirdly, always lend on discretion, never make it clear in advance, and always in penal terms to limit moral hazard. Moral hazard means if you make it too easy to borrow from the central bank, banks will take on too much risk. So you have to limit that expectation of reliance, of support, and punish them if they need support so that you control the moral hazard that otherwise would emerge in the system. So banking itself begins, as we said, Bank of Sweden, 1661, although account management actually developed in Amsterdam from the 1600s as well, but the Bank of England will then emerge 80, 90 years later. It's the most important central bank in the world, the main model for central banking, so almost all other later central banking practice comes out of the emerging, changing nature of the Bank of England over the next 200-300 years. Merchant banking, as we've said, these are the earlier goldsmith banks, which have got a deposit account function that then develop into the trade finance, the acceptance house practices, and the discount houses. So it's essentially trade finance is exchanging currencies with the acceptance house and the discount house. These are the early merchant banks. So it's commercial banking with deposit taking and trade finance all together. That trade finance activity will then emerge into what we call modern investment banking. They get involved with setting up companies, raising capital, advising, underwriting, all of traditional modern investment banking activity. However, we have to be clear. You've got commercial banking, you've got investment banking, and you've got merchant banking. And I explain this later in terms of the origins of banking in America, investment banking. The term investment bank is a misnomer. It's an accident of English-American translation. What happened was this. In America, you had the Great Depression in 1929, which led to the Wall Street collapse and the Great Depression, 1931-32, all followed the Wall Street collapse in 1929. The Americans had concluded the reason and primary cause for the Wall Street collapse in 1929 was that commercial banks were using deposits for investing on the securities market. So they wanted to separate securities markets and commercial banking. So Glass-Steagall, Senators Glass-Steagall sponsored this part of the Banking Act in 1933, and the Glass-Steagall in 1933, you separate commercial banking from investment, from securities business. For example, J.P. Morgan, the most famous banker in the world, has to split. So J.P. Morgan, I think was his brother, so Henry S. Morgan and Harold Stanley, they go and form Morgan Stanley. It's one of the early investment banks. And then what you'll see as well, J.P. Morgan Chase will merge with Chemical Bank to form J.P. Morgan, Chase Manhattan. That was in 2008. And then Chase Manhattan will buy J.P. Morgan in 2000. It's on the, let me just check the dates. Chase Manhattan is formed in 1996, and then in 2000 they buy J.P. Morgan to form the second largest commercial bank in America. But the whole point is this, going back to Glass-Steagall in 1933, the original J.P. Morgan had to be split into two. So Morgan Stanley is the securities business that was formerly carried out by J.P. Morgan, with J.P. Morgan subsequently becoming J.P. Morgan Chase. All of the other early American investment banks are also formed at this time. And I explain all of that later in the paper. And then how they changed and evolved and became the five major firms in Wall Street, with Goldman Sachs at the top, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, and then Bear Stearns. And that's all dealt with in the paper later. But the key issue simply is this. The term investment banking is an accident. It's a misnomer. It's an American securities house. An investment bank is not a bank. It cannot conduct deposit-taking business. It cannot do lending. It does securities-related activities. It does underwriting, advisory services, all of these types of things. It's a securities business. It's not a bank. And the problem that arose with the global financial crisis is that nobody understood this. And everybody got this all mixed up. So for 12 years, the press, when they were blaming and bashing the banks, they didn't even know what they were talking about. And people still don't. We need to understand this in terms of the early origins of these key terms. So what we have is this. We have commercial banking accepts deposits, it pools and on lends. Investment banking is a securities-only business. And a merchant bank is an old-fashioned type of British bank which can do both. So the merchant bank's in the middle. It essentially emerges out of the trade finance functions, which were assumed by the early Goldsmith bankers. So you've got the Goldsmith bankers providing deposit and lending, and then that emerges into the trade finance. So they can do both, but technically a commercial bank only does deposit and lending, an investment bank does security, and these are very separate. Only the investment bank and the merchant bank in the middle can do both. I then summarise the background to the international financial system in terms of the history of the gold standard, which technically begins in London in 1717 when Sir Isaac Newton, the master of the mint, mispriced the value of gold relative to silver. They overvalued silver, so all the silver left Great Britain. So what happened was we were forced by accident onto a gold standard because there was only gold left. It was a mistake. So we adopted a de facto gold standard from 1717. That becomes a formal gold standard just after the Napoleonic Wars, when Britain beat the French. I shouldn't say that. In 1812. And then we're going to develop later, that's the gold market. That's the gold specie market, which meant you could always exchange banknotes for gold. And the Bank of England was at the centre of the market in London. You could always exchange banknotes for gold. What we then also get is what we call a gold bullion standard and a gold exchange standard. Just during the 1800s, we develop a gold bullion standard, which means banks can exchange large value amounts for gold bullion, which is big bars, rather than small coins or whatever. That actually, I was told, emerges simply to allow banks in Scotland to manage their assets with the Bank of England. Instead of moving huge amounts of gold back and forward, they would have a gold bullion standard. The gold exchange standard begins just before the First World War in 1914, because a lot of the earlier Commonwealth countries that were attached to Great Britain, they want to not adopt the gold standard directly, but they're going to base their currencies, they're going to tie them to the sterling, to pound sterling. So it's a sterling-based gold exchange standard that emerges just before the First World War. What will then happen is after the Second World War, Britain basically wins two world wars, but it basically destroys its gold reserves, destroys its currency reserves. We haven't any assets left. So America takes over, becomes the most powerful economy in the world. It wasn't simply because of the wars, but America just is the largest economy in the world, and the dollar becomes the most important reserve currency in the world. So therefore, we'll get this shift to the new currencies with this movement, and dollar will replace sterling over time. So we create a substitute form of gold exchange standard, whereby instead of tying gold to sterling and currencies will tie their value to sterling, we're going to tie all the currencies in the world to gold, and gold will be tied to the dollar at $35 per ounce under the Bretton Woods system. I explain the background to Bretton Woods and the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the paper. We'll then get later crises. During the 1970s and 1980s, we create what we call the petrodollar market. The petrodollar market is essentially, after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in 1973, the key international commodity that's valued in dollars is oil. Because the value of the dollar collapses after the closure of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, 71, 72, 73, and we go on floating currencies, the value of oil contracts around the world collapses as well. So what happens is they massively increase the price of oil, 1973, and then again in 1979. There's actually some interesting background to this in terms of what we call the petrodollar system. Essentially, what had happened was America realized that oil production was always going to be very important. So it enters into a relationship with Saudi Arabia as early as 1937. A lot of the Middle Eastern countries will not even find their oil till 1960s, 1970s, like Abu Dhabi. But Saudi Arabia had oil from an early stage. So America enters into a close relationship, this restores diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia in 1937. There's a formal mutual defence pact entered into in 1951. And then in 1973, what the Americans do very, very, very cleverly, they agree with Saudi Arabia that Saudi Arabia will only sell its oil to America and anybody else in the world in dollars. So that the dollar becomes the key currency that supports the whole of the oil market. What then happened was all the other Middle Eastern countries, they do the same as well. We call that the petrodollar system, whereby all oil in the world is effectively sold in terms of dollars. And this actually creates, I think it's something like, that market's worth $3.2 trillion. There's something like $88 million a barrel of oil created a day. At $100 per barrel, that's $3.2 trillion. An enormous market. And where did all that money go? It was all created in dollars. All the oil sold in dollars. And the Saudi Arabians also agreed that any surplus assets they would recycle through American Treasury bill market. Although a lot of the oil receipts actually come through London, and we get a lot of the backbone to the Eurodollar market is actually based on petrodollars as well, whereby we recycle all these excess funds. Initially, what effectively is happening is this. All the oil in the world, $3.2 trillion a year, is bought in dollars. A lot of that's initially invested in the Treasury bill market, but then we've too many bills in New York, so all that's moved back to London, and then that's then recycled around the world. And that's the backbone to what actually happened with the expansion and growth of the euro dollar market during the 1970s. What that specifically meant was this. A lot of other emerging economies around the world, such as Mexico, Brazil, Peru, all these other developing economies, they borrow massive amounts to look after, to develop welfare programs, build hospitals, schools, transport systems for their own people. The problem was they borrowed too much. We have a turn down in the American, the global economy, early 1980s in America and elsewhere. And by 1981, 82, a lot of the emerging economies had borrowed too much and couldn't repay it. This is the beginning of what we call the third world debt crisis. So in the text, I explain all of this. Mexico declares, just announces to the world, to America and the rest of the world, that on 13th August 1982, we cannot repay our debt. And they just tell the rest of the world, and all the big banks in the world. Most of all of this having been borrowed through the Eurodollar system. Then Brazil again defaults in November 1982. This then spreads around Latin America, the Caribbean, Africa and the Middle East. Everything's in the paper. So essentially what we have to do is we'll get the background to the Eurodollar system, the background to the third world debt crisis, and the need to renegotiate all of this. The big banks don't want to write off the debt. So what you do is this, you extend the duration and you reduce the interest payments, which is exactly what happened dealing with Greece following the global financial crisis. The big international banks, but even more so the large international financial institutions such as the IMF, the IFC and the World Bank, they didn't want to write off the debt to Greece, but what they did was they reduced the payments, the interest and they extend the duration. So a lot of this began or was carried out with the third world debt crisis back in the 1980s. We then have the Asia financial crisis, 1997, 2nd July 1997, with the collapse of economies all across Asia, beginning with the Thai baht in July 1997, which then extends into the first Russian crisis a year later, and we'll look at some of the litigation that erupted from that, in particular with what's called the Springwell decision. Then later, subsequently, almost 10 years exactly after that, we have the global financial crisis beginning in 2007-2008, where basically we're into what we call the structured finance market. Collateralized debt obligations supported by what are called credit default swaps in the derivatives area. We basically create massive amounts of structured finance debt that's on an originate to distribute model, which means you make it, you build it and you sell it, you get it off your balance sheet. Most banking assets like a traditional loan are originate to hold. You have a long term relationship with your borrower, 10-20 years. That's originate to hold. In the structured finance market, the securities market, it's originate to distribute. You build the CDOs, you sell all, you create all these new securities and you sell it. If you don't sell, you're left holding all of this when the market collapses, and that's exactly what happens 2007-2008. I explain the background to all of this in the text and we'll come back and look at all of that later. But we can understand the whole of the international financial system for the last 300-500 years, almost 1,000-2,000 years through these basic outlines. The rest of the paper then looks at the money markets, the capital markets, the Eurodollar markets, the currency markets and the derivatives markets, as well as the gold market, commodity markets and insurance markets. I then re-examine those by looking at the key instruments, claims and products dealt with on each market. So coinage, banknotes, foreign exchange, certificates of deposit, account credits, promissory notes, bills of exchange, checks. All a check is a bill of exchange drawn on a bank. The two merchants don't draw the bill on each other, they draw on a bank. All a bill of exchange is legally, a cheque is legally a bill of exchange drawn on a bank. And that's actually provided for under the Bills of Exchange Act. And you'll see that in the text. So then we have cheques, traveller's cheques, banker's drafts, banker's acceptances, electronic and digital money, public debt, government bills, government bonds and gilts, corporate bonds and shares, depository receipts, and then on risk and investment assets, forward contracts, financial futures, financial options and swaps. We're into the derivatives market. Then we're looking at specific types of swaps, total return swaps, credit default swaps, credit spread swaps. We'll come back and look at all of these in further detail. And then we're into the structured finance market. Credit linked notes, collateralized debt obligations. And then finally, we have other commodity markets. And the commodity markets include gold and silver. Gold and silver is not money, it's a commodity. I then deal with the importance of international financial centres. London is still the primary international financial centre in the world. So we look at the background to that and the various activities. International banking, investment banking, international bonds, equities, foreign exchange, financial derivatives, asset management, gold building, insurance, marine services. The size of all of these markets I deal with separately in the other paper on the City of London, we look at all of these in almost identical terms, and I build in all the sizes of each of these markets. The paper then explains the nature of modern investment banking. Investment banking business is equity and debt underwriting. Market making and trading, asset management, advisory services, trade finance, foreign exchange and financial derivatives, prime brokerage, and then other activities including structured finance. Prime brokerage is acting for hedge funds. Hedge funds need a whole series of services, including lending, dealing, arranging deals and securities, custody services, exchange services, all sorts of services. All of that collectively is called prime brokerage. One of the difficulties that arose with the global financial crisis was that Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment firm on Wall Street, was the largest prime broker in the world. So what happened was, when the Americans did not support Lehman Brothers, after JP Morgan Chase tried to buy it, but then bought Merrill Lynch instead, and after Bank of America purchased Merrill Lynch instead of Lehman, and then because Barclays Bank couldn't purchase Lehman Brothers, the American authorities forced the closure of Lehman on 14th, 15th September, Monday of September 2008. One of the major difficulties that arose was Lehman was one of the largest, if not the largest, prime brokerage firm in the world. That meant that hundreds, thousands of hedge funds around the world had all of their assets frozen in Lehman. And they couldn't use them, they couldn't exercise them, they couldn't do anything with them for a year, 2 years, because of the litigation that ensued after that. Because the Americans had allowed JP Morgan Chase, a commercial bank, to buy Bear Stearns, the fifth largest investment firm in Wall Street, in March 2008, using a $30 billion facility made available under the discount window in America, a form of lender of last resort. But they wouldn't do the same again to allow Barclays Bank to buy Lehman 6 months later, in September 2008. That's what caused the global financial crisis, and one of the ancillary effects of that was Lehman Brothers was the largest prime brokerage firm in the world. In terms of the development, I explained the background to all of the earlier securities houses in America. So we look at restate the issue with regards to Glass-Steagall, and then with the early firms, with Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, Kuhn Lieb, Dillon Reed in the 1940s, 1950s, and then later on, this will restate itself with the five largest modern investment firms just before the global financial crisis: Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and then I restate all of this again from a British perspective. So we have the famous British names such as Hamrose, Flemings, Barings, and then there's Morgan Grenfell, N.F. Schroeder, S.G. Warburg, and how all of these were subsequently acquired by American and other institutions. And then look at the nature, growth, and expansion of investment banking on the European continent. The difference on mainland Europe is that the big commercial banks in Europe are allowed to do securities business. In America, they're not, because of Glass-Steagall until 1999 with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. On the European continent, they were always allowed to do commercial business. So in Europe, the big banks, Deutsche Bank, Paribas, they can do banking, commercial banking, and securities business together. In America, it was illegal. In Britain, it was just a matter of commercial practice that we separated the commercial banks and the investment banks, mainly because Britain had developed companies, company law, corporate law, all began in the United Kingdom. The first company in the world was, does anybody know? It was actually the Aberdeen Harbour Authority in Scotland in 1135. First company in the world was set up in Scotland, 1135, the Aberdeen Harbour Authority. The first modern company was actually the Dutch East India Company, which I think was 1602. But then what happens is this: there's a series of key legislative changes brought into effect in the United Kingdom. What we had was, in 1837, there's five key dates, 1837, we could actually create companies by Parliament under what were called letters patent. So for the first time, you didn't have to go to the King or the Queen. You could create a company through Parliament by letters patent, 1837. Very important, 1837. But then what happened was in 1844, we had the first Joint Stock Companies Act. And I'll give you a separate summary of companies law, and I've got another paper on corporate finance law. 1844, we had the first Joint Stock Companies Act in the world. Why is that important? For the first time ever, seven people could sign a document and create a legal person. For the first time in history, you could create a legal person without procreation, without having to go to the king or queen or go to your wife. For the first time ever in history, voluntary creation of a separate legal person for business purposes, 1844. 1855, we then give that company limited liability. We then have, we consolidate all of the early company laws, 1856. And then modern company laws based on the Companies Act 1985 and then 2006 in the UK. Many other countries in the world simply copy that. So how did corporate form? How is modern capitalism actually created, built and sustained? Through the company. Why is the company so important? Limited liability. Separate legal personality. Perpetual succession. How did all the rich families in the world lose all their money? In France, in Germany, Britain and elsewhere. Inheritance taxes. How do companies keep their wealth? They go on forever, unless they're wound up. So, separate personality, limited liability, perpetual succession. And the genius of this was all developed in Britain in the 1800s. 1837, 1844, 1855, then 1856, 1985 and 2006. I then explain, so the difference on the continent is that the big banks could do securities business, there was no separation, there was no legal restriction. In America, that was legally restricted under Glass-Steagall, 1933, until Gramm-Leach-Bliley, 1999. In Britain, there was no legal requirement, but just as a matter of market practice, we would separate commercial and investment banking. In Japan, we have the four big securities houses. We have Nomura, we have Daiwa, we have Nikko, and then we have Yamichi. So I explain all of that in the paper as well. And then I also review the importance of international commercial banking, including what we said before about international capital standards and the relevance of this 8% minimum. All of this is dealt with in the paper as well. And then we go into the other key parts of the markets. We're going to look at the euro loan market. We're going to look at the euro bond market. Commercial paper, euro note system, and then also the paper deals builds in project finance, securitization, structured finance, and financial derivatives. All of this is dealt with in this key paper. It provides a complete background to all aspects of modern international finance and international finance law, which we will examine in further detail separately through the course.